Hey everybody, and welcome back to Serial Zombie Mom. Today's case is going to turn into a multi-parter. I'm going to try and get it all down as concise as I can into like two parts, because there is a lot of information. The best way that I'm going to do this one, unfortunately, just because I had notes all over the place and I think I went on tangents and different things. I'm going to get into just a little bit about Charles Lindbergh himself, because this is about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. I'm going to talk a little bit about him himself, just really quickly, just so you understand, like, he was just a major figure during the time period. And then also, then I'll get into the case itself. There's a lot of information, a lot of kind of crazy shit that happened, but I can't get into every little ounce of detail because it's just a lot. So bear with me just a little bit. I'm gonna try and get through this information as well as possible. I have had to take little sections pretty much straight from Wikipedia, and then others from like Murderpedia and some of these other websites. So that's where I've gotten some of the information. I have watched multiple documentaries, read articles, different things like that to get the information. Okay, so as far as how I execute this, it might be just a little bit different from what I normally do. So I'm just trying to find something that's just a little bit more, I don't know, something that flows just a little bit better than what I've had in the past. But we'll kind of see how this goes. So as far as the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, Charles Augustus Lindbergh was born on February 4th, 1902. Now, he was best known as an American aviator, military officer, inventor, and an activist. Okay, now after making a nonstop flight from New York City to Paris, he immediately made newspapers and everyone knew his name. All right, now he then wins the Ortieg Prize for his flight, which covered 33.5 hours and 3,600 miles alone in a single-engine Ryan monoplane, and the name of the plane was the Spirit of St. Louis. Now, this had been done before with multiple people in the same plane. That way they kind of took breaks. One could nap while the other one, you know, navigated the course and so on and so forth. But Charles Lindbergh did this alone. No one to help him 33 and a half hours straight. Dude was probably really tired by the time that he got out of that plane. Now, he was very well known, and married Anne Morrow in 1929. Now, Charles was called Lucky Lindy, as well as a couple of other names, and known all over the world for this flight. Like, everyone knew. He had made national attention. Everyone in the country knew who Lucky Lindy was, who Charles Lindbergh was. Now, he was a hometown hero, and everyone seemed to look up to him. The couple welcomed baby Charles Augustus Lindbergh Jr. on June 22nd of 1930 in Englewood, New Jersey. He had dad's cleft chin. He had this beautiful, curly, kind of blonde hair. And overall was just known to be a beautiful baby. Now, the unfortunate thing was that a lot of people didn't really know a lot about baby Charles. Okay. During this time period, you've got to think, you know, Great Depression is coming up, like, all of this stuff is happening, and, you know, he's so well known, Charles is so well known that he's like, you know, we're gonna keep him out of the limelight a little bit. So a lot of people didn't see pictures of this baby. So when people started to question, you know, why aren't we seeing, you know, is there something wrong with him? Is he deformed? Is there, you know, does he have some sort of disability? Like, is something wrong or, you know, whatever. So they started to have all these questions about him. A lot of people wanted to know, you know, why aren't you putting your child in the limelight? A lot of other people were, look here, you know, we've had this baby, but You know, ultimately we find out that no, the kid was fine. He was a beautiful child. Now, on March 1st, 1932, when Charles Augustus was only about 20 months old, he was tucked into his bed. He had recently gotten over a cold. His mother had gotten the cold. And she, I believe, was pregnant again at this time. And so, therefore, you know, they had a nursemaid that came in to help and would help check on him and help get him to bed and things like that. Now, when she went in to check on him later, it was approximately around 10 p.m., this nurse, Betty Gow, realizes that baby was not in his crib and was not with his mother, who had just gotten out of the bath. At this point, they alert Charles Sr. He was up immediately to check the room and finds a ransom note with really bad handwriting and grammatical errors in an envelope on the windowsill. At this point, Charles takes a gun, goes around the house to kind of, you know, check the grounds, see if they see anything. He and their butler, Ollie Watley, actually go, or it's Watley, I'm sorry. They go and they check the grounds around the house. They find different impressions in the ground under where the baby's room would be. But, you know, they also noticed that there were pieces of a makeshift homemade ladder that were strewn about on the property as well. And they were able also to find one of his baby blankets that was obviously, you know, put in the crib with him when he was put down to sleep. So Waterly, the butler, telephones the Hopewell Police Department, and Charles contacts his attorney and his best friend, you know, Henry Breckenridge, as well as the state police. Now, the police come in, state police, the Hopewell police, like all of them, and they're going to search this area. Okay. Excuse me. After midnight, they bring in a fingerprint expert. Now, just keep in mind, it's only been about 30 years or so that fingerprints have really been a thing. Okay. So they bring somebody in to really kind of check out the ransom note, check out the ladder. But unfortunately, there's no usable fingerprints or footprints found on the property. At this point, they believe, obviously, that the kidnappers wore gloves or had some sort of cloth tied around their shoes to not make an impression. Now, no adult fingerprints were found in the baby's room, including the areas where witnesses admitted that they had actually touched those areas, such as the window. But the baby's fingerprints were all found. So there's a little bit of speculation here. Some people will say, well, you know, does that mean somebody wiped things down? Does that mean, you know, but that's not necessary, not necessarily true. It could just be that there were no usable prints. They say no adult fingerprints were found, but if we get really down into the nitty-gritty, they found stuff that could have been fingerprints, but there's also the very good possibility that, you know, someone might have been wearing gloves, or the fingerprints just weren't legible enough to be able to see defining factors. Now, a brief handwritten ransom note, and I'm just going to read it out really quick and kind of explain how this is. I went through one podcast that kind of read everything out. They did it really, really well, as well as a book that, you know, you get to see all of this in. And it says, "Dear Sir, ! Have $50,000 with the dollar sign after the amount, ready, R-E-D-Y, 25,000 with the dollar sign after, in $20 bills, 15,000 in $10 bills, and 10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you were to deliver the money. Money spelled M-O-N-Y. We warn you for making any ding public or for notifying or for notify the police the child is in good care. Indication for all letters are signature and three holes. Holes spelled H-O-H-L-S. When you look at this letter, you can tell this person is not English speaking, or at least English is not their first language. Okay, you get the exclamation point after dear sir. Only a few different dialects do this in their writing. The handwriting, you can tell that they were contemplating, you know, the spelling of a word. The fact that the dollar bill mark was after the amounts also told us things. R-E-D-Y for ready. Good for good care. G-U-T. So you can tell they're trying to write things out phonetically to their own accent. Now, on the signature, and when we look at the bottom of the note, where there are two interconnected blue circles surrounding an actual red circle. And then there's a hole punched in the middle of the red circle and two holes punched on either side of the interconnected blue rings. It's really interesting, and I'm going to have to try and share a picture of what this looks like. There is a recreation that's a little more, you know, perfect. It's obviously a digital recreation of what the signature would look like, but it's very interesting to see. Now, obviously, with this little boy gone, word of the kidnapping spreads like wildfire. People are coming from all over the place trying to help find this baby. Unfortunate thing is, as people didn't really know enough, and I laugh about this because when our cousin told me to check out the Vera Regal case, you know, she and I had been talking about the Pepin sisters and how you don't touch the bodies. Well, you don't mess with the crime scene, you know, don't mess with the crime scene. And all these people were coming in and they were trying to help. But by doing so, they come in and they're trampling the grounds. Any other things that may have been there, they are ruining more footprints. They are not getting plaster imprints of footprints. They haven't done any of that. They're touching things without gloves. You know, you've got people just interfering and getting in the way, and it's just ruining the fact that there was a crime scene there, okay? So even though they were well-intentioned, it wound up hurting the case even more because then they could not really deduce what pieces belonged to the case and what pieces were just left by bystanders. Now, military colonels offered their aid, although only one had law enforcement expertise. This was Herbert Norman Schwarzkopf. Everybody's heard that name at some point where, you know, what do you think? You think you're Schwarzkopf? You know, you think I've heard a couple of different things. But he was very well known for this case, and he was the superintendent of the New Jersey State Police. Other colonels were Henry Breckinridge, who was also that friend of Charles Lindbergh, a Wall Street lawyer, and William Donovan, who was also a World War hero. Now, the former runner of the CIA, William Donovan also would later head the Office of Strategic Services, which is the forerunner to the CIA. Lindbergh and these men speculated that the kidnapping was perpetrated by organizing crime figures. They even thought that the letter would be written by someone with German as a native language. And as we go through this and as you hear more about the case, we will all feel the same way. Definitely someone who was foreign speaking. And at this point, Charles is like, well, I know all these people. Everybody knows me. Like, I'm going to use this and we're going to direct this investigation. We are really going to control this because this is my son. Like, I want my son home. Like, I need my baby home. So they contact Mickey Rosner, who is a Broadway hanger-on, which means that he was fluently in the mix with mobsters. He knew a lot of people. Now, he turned to two speakeasy owners, Salvatore Spitali and Irving Bitz, for aid. Goes into them, you know, look, we're looking at these crime bosses, we're looking at these crime organizations, you know, what do you guys know? Because little Indy's gone. He's gone. Somebody's got to know something. Now, we're immediately looking at this. The U.S. is immediately looking at this option. And they look to a couple of different major crime figures, such as Willie Moretti, Al Capone, Joe Adonis, and Abner Zwillman. These people were speaking even from prison, saying that, yeah, we can get help for you, you just give us money, you know, favors, put us money in our accounts, you know, that kind of deal. Help us, and we'll help you. Even though they knew that they didn't know shit, but they were going to try and use that to their advantage, and try and get, you know, some sort of monetary gain from this tragedy. All right, so with that information, you know, I think they start to really realize that, you know, maybe this whole organized crime thing might just be a fluke. You know, I don't think that might necessarily be the issue. And the morning after the kidnapping, authorities notify Herbert Hoover. Being the president at the time, he immediately is like, all hands on deck. This is a state crime. You know, but didn't really seem to have any grounds for federal involvement. However, he still looked at it as, you know, a tragic thing for Charles. You know, I understand this. You know, I know this sucks, but, you know, kidnappings happen a lot. You know, we can't put it at a federal level because, you know, other things, not to mean they're more important, but, you know, some other things have to take precedence. You'll have to do this at a state level. You know, we've got a lot going on right now in the country as it is. So Attorney General William D. Mitchell met with Hoover and announced that the whole machinery of the Department of Justice would be set in motion to cooperate with the New Jersey authorities, saying, you know, hey, we're not going to take the limelight off of other things that are going on here, but we do need the assistance, you know, so we're going to do this. We're going to help, and we're going to do what we can do, but, you know, I mean, the country still needs to run, you know, whatever. So the Bureau investigation, which turns into the FBI, is then authorized to investigate the case. All right, it does become a political thing. It does become a major thing, all right? So New Jersey officials at this point announce that there is a $25,000 reward for the safe return of Little Indy. Now, the Lindbergh family actually adds an additional $50,000 reward of their own, bringing it up to about $75,000, which was a lot of money. A ton of money. This was 1930? 1932? We're in the middle of the Great Depression. I mean, that's a lot of money. When we look at inflation and look at how much money that really was, you know, that $75,000 in today's money would be over $1,172,000. So we're looking at, you know, $1.25 million? That's a lot of money. So being in the Great Depression, obviously everyone at this point is looking. Like everyone, it's like, look at the amount of money. Like we could take care of ourselves and our family for the rest of our lives on this. Like, they would never want for anything. Now on March 6th, a new ransom letter arrives by mail at the Lindbergh home. The letter is postmarked March 4th in Brooklyn. And it carried the same perforated red and blue marks, like the inner, you know, connected circles. But the ransom is now raised to $70,000. So they want an extra $20,000 from what they originally wanted. A third ransom note is postmarked from Brooklyn, and also included the secret marks, but this one was sent to Breckenridge's mail. The note tells the Lindberghs that a Mr. John Condon needs to be the intermediary, the safe person between the kidnappers and the Lindbergh family. At this way, they even went as far as saying, you know, that we need notification through the newspaper that, you know, this is going to be the case. We need this as an okay. We need to know that you guys agree with, you know, this arrangement. He's going to be the mediary, you know, whatever. So they agree. And at this point, they let them know there's, I forget exactly what the quote was of what was put in the paper. But it's pretty much stating, all right, fine, we're going to do this, whatever. So they get another letter. Instructions at this point specify the size of the box the money should come in. And even warned the family, you know, not to contact the police, don't get involved, like, don't be part of this. Well, during this time, John Condon, who is a Bronx personality, he's a retired school teacher, and, you know, he even goes as far as offering $1,000 if the kidnapper would turn the police over to a Catholic priest. You know, hey, you know, just stop whatever you did, you know, I'll give you $1,000 if you just turn them over, because, you know, then that way you won't get in any trouble, you know, you'll be safe, baby will be safe, you know, whatever. Lindbergh, you know, even agrees, like, all right, he's going to be this intermediary, we got to do what they want us to do. And he goes by the nickname of Jafsie, okay, J-A-F-S-I-E. Because they're like, you know, if I put my name in the paper that John Condon, you know, it's me, John Condon, then everybody's going to know that he's this intermediary and he's the one helping to do this. And then everybody's going to ask him questions. And then the police are going to get even more involved. And then it's just going to be a nightmare for everyone involved. Okay. So this meeting, he gets to set up a meeting. And a meeting between Jafsie and a representative of the kidnapping group decide they're going to meet at Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. Now, according to Condon, the man sounded foreign but stayed in the shadows during the conversation. And Condon was unable to get a good look at his face. Like, you know, he was kind of in the shadows. He was able to see little bits and shadows and little spots of his face, but couldn't really see much. So the man said his name was John, and at this point, everybody talked about him as Cemetery John, okay? So this John relates the story to John Condon, stating, you know, I'm a Scandinavian sailor, part of a gang of three men and two women. The baby's being held on a boat, but he's unharmed. He'll be fine. And he'll be returned, you know, once I get the money. So then John Condon says that, you know, he wasn't 100% sure that the guy had the baby. He's like, you know, I don't know, just kind of the way he's acting. I just don't know if he's actually got this baby. So he's like, you know, I want some proof. The kidnapper then says, I'll return with the baby's sleeping suit. So in other words, kind of like a onesie, you know, sleeping suit. And he says, you know, but, he makes this little comment that kind of makes you think, and I think this is part of the reason why John Condon is wondering, you know, about the safety of the baby. Because this guy says, you know, would I burn if the package were dead? So would I burn if the little boy was already dead? Like, it makes you think, you know, okay, what is he doing? Is he screwing with me here? Or, you know, does he even have the kid? Or is this a joke or what? So, but he assures him and says, no, the baby's fine. He's, you know, I've got somebody watching him. Like, we're taking care of him. We just want the money. So fast forward a little bit more to March 16th. Condon then receives a package with a toddler's sleeping suit and a seventh ransom note. Okay. Seventh ransom note. So there's been so many messages coming and going back and forth between them. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You think at this point, you know, get the damn police looking at the fucking fingerprints again. Like, what the hell? Like, seven different ones and you can't pinpoint shit? I mean, granted, they didn't have, you know, CODIS or any of that anymore, or they didn't have it yet, so how were they going to look? They were going to have to do everything by hand. They were going to have to look at everything manually and, like, with their own eyes. They weren't going to be able to do it through, like, a computer. They didn't have that shit back then. Now, if Lindbergh, or after he identified and said, you know what, yeah, this sleeping suit is Lindy's, this is, you know, this is my baby's, this is definitely his, then John Condon places another ad in the and says, money ready, no cops, no Secret Service, I come alone just like last time. And on April 1st, he receives another letter saying that it was time for the ransom to be delivered. So, here they are, you know, they've fought a couple of times about how the hell they were going to do this. How were they going to get this ransom payment? Like, how they were going to track it, how they were going to be able to find who had it, okay? Now, the ransom was packaged in a wooden box that was custom made in hope that it would be later identified pretty easily. Because, you know, you could tell by the maker's mark and, you know, specific, you know, marks in the grain and knots in the wood. Excuse me. To be able to identify these things. Well, and they're like, you know, well, we're not going to look at every serial number. We're not gonna, you know, do anything crazy with this stuff, with this money, so, because then they're gonna know. Like, we can't give them fake money, we can't give them, you know, marked bills, because they did do that kind of stuff. So they were like, alright, so let's do this. This is gonna be a little bit interesting. So keep this in mind. They were getting ready, at this point, to swap over from the gold standard, okay? So what better to do but put this all in a number of gold certificates and set everything up that way? Like, all this stuff was about to be withdrawn. Like, they were switching over from that gold standard. So it would be a little bit more obvious if somebody started to use these things. So they used a good bit of those to try and get, you know, get some help here. Now, the bills were not marked, but they were able to record every single serial number off of every single bill. These charts of numbers were then distributed so that people could identify certain serial numbers. Now, some sources credit this to Frank J. Wilson, others to Elmer Lincoln Irie. But, you know, I mean, it's not really 100% clear as to, you know, who thought up the plan. Now, the next day, Condon is given a note by an intermediary who happened to be just an unknown cab driver. And I think what it was is that somebody just said, you know, hey, you're already going over here. Give this letter to this guy. And I think that's just kind of how it went. It was super simple. Condon then meets with Cemetery John again and tells him, look, we've done the best that we can do. Here we are in the Great Depression. Granted, they had the fucking money, but look, we were only able to raise about $50,000. You know, we tried to get the extra $25,000. But we couldn't do it. He's a little more hard up for money than people thought he was right now. And he essentially lies to Cemetery John just to get out of an extra $25,000 for them. And the man says, you know what? Fine. If all I can get is 50, that's all I can get. Fine. It's still a lot of fucking money. I'll take the money. You know, yeah, we wanted a little bit more, but guess what? I'll take it. I mean, it's like if you know, the lottery thing said, you know, I'm gonna give you $1 billion. Well, guess what? We really only had funds for, you know, 800 and some odd million. I'd still take the 800 and some odd million. You know? It's kind of a common sense thing. You're gonna take it or not? So here he thinks he's helping out Charles Lindbergh. Okay? There is this ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous treasure hunt for giving up the ransom money. I mean, when I say ridiculous, I mean, they tell him, like, you're going to go to this place and this note's going to be under a rock and then that's going to send you to another place and then so on and so forth. So they go and they find the rock, they get that letter, and then they go and look in a can somewhere, and then they go look under a glass bottle, and then they, like, all these different places to go to, and then finally get the address of where they're going to meet to drop off the money. When they get to this location, it's like, you know, leave the car running, leave the money in the car, and, you know, and get out of here, and then we'll take it. So they go and they hide in the bushes, and they're waiting to kind of watch, and they see somebody kind of get in and out of there, but they're not able to catch up. It's ridiculous. And then they're like, okay, well, you know, where's the baby? Where's the baby? And they're like, well, you know, you'll get him. It's going to be X amount of days, you know, 2 days or whatever like that. And you'll get him back. Well, and then there's 2 days come and go. And it just keeps taking time and keeps taking time. And time is just just being wasted and wasted and wasted. And I don't know. Like, they just start feeling like there's something not right. Like, things are not happening the way they should. Like, something's not right here. Let's fast forward a little bit longer. May 12th. A delivery truck driver named Orville Wilson and his assistant, William Allen, pulled to the side of the road about 4.5 miles south of the Lindbergh home near the hamlet of Mount Rose. When William Allen goes off the side of the road to pee, because essentially, like, that's why they pulled over. Hey, dude, I gotta pee. Like, you know, just pull over really quick. Let me run into the woods and pee real quick. He finds the body of a toddler. When they alert officials, you know, they come out and look. They see the skull was badly fractured and the body was decomposed with evidence of scavenging by animals. So where they had animal predation, where there were things eaten away. Okay. There were indications that the baby was just quickly buried really fast so as not to be found, you know, or be, you know, seen right away. The nurse, Miss Gao, is the one that actually had to identify the baby. She does this because the only slight deformation, I guess, that you would call it. You know, everybody wondered about those kinds of things, and we realized that, no, this baby was perfectly fine, but there was a little overlapping of the toes on the right foot. So Miss Gao was able to see this and was like, oh, that's our baby. That's the Lindbergh's baby. She also quickly identified the shirt, the sleep shirt that she had sewn for him that night. Because back then, some of the pieces of fabric, like to make some of the outfits, you know, you'd just sew them together right then, put them on them, like, and there you go. They'll wear it for a couple of days and then it gets chucked, you know, or it would be just something easy. And it appeared that something happened as a major blow to the head. Because of all this, Charles Lindbergh Sr. could not face doing anything but a cremation. It was the only option that they could think to do because he was not going to let his wife Annie see that. It just didn't make sense to them to put their family through even more heartache. Now, in June of 1932, officials began to look at people that the Lindbergh family knew. They looked at Violet Sharp, who was a British household servant at the Morrow home. She'd given some not so great information as to where she was on the night of the kidnapping. You know, said she appeared really nervous, very suspicious when questioned. It could just be she was freaked out because she'd never had to deal with cops before. Or it could be she was totally involved. Personally, I feel she was absolutely involved because here she was in the home of a very prevalent person. And shortly after being questioned, she committed suicide on June 10th of 1932 by ingesting a silver polish that contained cyanide. She had been questioned four times. Four times. And then killed herself. Makes you wonder what she might have known. Okay? That was very suspicious. However, her alibi was later confirmed. So, knowing this, it makes you wonder just how heavy-handed or how badly she had been interrogated by the police. Some tactics can be a little bit rough, especially if, you know, I mean, once somebody shows a little bit of hesitation or a little bit of awkwardness, anything that's a little sus, and they're immediately like, you did it, you did it, you did it, you know something. Well, you know, it could just be that the person's freaked out. She may have anxiety issues. You know, there's really no telling, but being questioned four times and she's like, I don't know anything and they're never gonna leave me alone. I need to off myself. Again, this was a very, very desperate time. Now, John Condon was also questioned by police and his home searched at this point because they're like, well, you know, how come you were this intermediary? Why were you the one chosen? Who did you know and what did they know? Like, what did you know? Now, after this discovery of little Lindy's body, John Condon remained unofficially involved in the case. And to the public, he had become a suspect just because of his knowledge and, you know, becoming this intermediary. He pledged at this point. He's like, you know, I'm gonna fight. I'm gonna find this cemetery, John. Like, I know who I talked to. Like, I know I saw, I'll know this person if I see them. So, you know, 2 years, 2 years he goes on to try and fight and try and find Cemetery John. Now, John Condon's actions regarding the case were increasingly just wild and speculative, and like he wanted to kind of be in the limelight, it seemed. It's kind of like when we go back to the West Memphis Three and we see John Mark Byers as being, you know, this character and really kind of making a show for the cameras. You know, this guy, granted it wasn't cameras and stuff then, but he was really like interviews and things like that. Like there was a lot. Okay. On one occasion, he's actually riding a city bus and he claims that, you know, I saw the guy. He was on the street, you know, and he announces his secret identity, saying, you know, I am Jaffsy, I'm Jaffsy, and he tells the bus to stop. Like, I gotta go find Cemetery John. It's him. It's a the startled driver, like, actually stops. Like, he's like, okay, you know, whatever, like, get off my fucking bus. And when he jumps from the bus, you know, he runs after this person he thinks is Cemetery John. But unfortunately, you know, the guy either wasn't him or he got away. Now, John's actions were actually criticized as exploitative because he agrees to start doing a tell-all. Liberty Magazine actually publishes a serialized account of John Condon's involvement under the title Jaffsy Tells All. He is a whistleblower at this point. He says everything he can think of, okay? Now, next thing before I break for part one, tracking the ransom money. Now, the investigators who were working on the case are stuck. At this point, there's nothing else they can do. No more information's coming in. No more evidence is coming in. Like, they're done. There's nothing. They're watching for the money, for the gold certificates. They're getting nothing. So, what do you do? So, a pamphlet is prepared. They send out this paper with all these serial numbers because now that the ransom, you know, has been handed over, they're looking. 250,000 copies of this pamphlet are distributed to businesses, mainly in New York City. Okay. A few in the surrounding areas. And they start seeing a few of these ransom bills appearing in a couple of little scattered locations, some as far away as Chicago and Minneapolis. But those spending the bills were never found. At this point, the president orders that all gold certificates are to be exchanged for other bills on May 1st of 1933. This was the exchange from the gold standard to what we know today. Now, a few days before this deadline, a man brought $2,980 to a Manhattan bank for exchange. They later realize these are bills that were from the ransom. He gave his name as J.J. Faulkner, but no one named Faulkner lived at the address that he had given the bank. They find out that a Jane Faulkner, who had lived there about 20 years earlier, didn't know anything about this. They heard of a name that somebody that may have lived there. It could have been they found an old document, you know, from someone that had lived there, or someone knew of someone. And then they were like, oh, or it could have been a coincidence, you know, but it's kind of hard to tell. So unfortunately, at this point, we're at a dead end. There's still a lot of information to come, so I'm going to stop right here and leave you with a little bit of wonder on the mystery of what happened and who did it. And, you know, then we'll go into more detail on the next episode. So I hope this one has you intrigued because we're going to find out a little bit more in this second half of this story, of this case. So we'll get into that here in just a bit. I may release this same day, and it could be that you have to wait another day or more for it. So we'll see. But I'm going to get into who was arrested and exactly what happened on the next one. If you will, email me, serialzombiemoms@gmail.com. Hit me up on the Facebook group or on the Instagram, and I will share all the pictures that I possibly can. I know I got to get caught up a little bit. I'm having to do it all on my own now because my friend that was helping me on all this had a lot of stuff come up, and now she can't do it. So, yeah. So I'm going to try and have to do all this by myself. And I've had some crazy shit coming up this last couple weeks. So it's been a little bit of a hectic lifestyle for me to try and get all this done. So bear with me. I'm doing my best. But I appreciate you guys listening, and I will see you on the next one.